Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming. The hashtag for this event, because I always forget that now, so I briefly tell you, is LSE Europe. You're all here to hear the book launch of Jan Szilonka's new book, Counter-Revolution, Liberal Europe in Retreat, which is a long letter to Ralph Dahndorf. He is the Ralph Dahndorf Fellow at St. Anthony's College in Oxford. I asked him how I should introduce him because, you know, it's always this funny thing, you get all this blurb, that's partly why you're here, because you want to see that famous person, so why should I read out that blurb again to you? And he told me something really quite interesting. Jan had to, you know, flee, basically, Poland under martial law, and has never since bothered to reclaim his Polish passport for a long time. He couldn't go back, so he was a Polish native. Became a Dutch citizen, is now resident basically in Italy, and pays his taxes in Britain. So this sums up what a European can be these days, and he's talking about that Europe that may be in retreat, where you have to be resident, where you pay your taxes, and cannot so easily go back and forth and not hold another passport. Or is that what it is about, Jan?
This institute is really our tougher competition to Oxford. So I always look with envy and respect. But I'm also delighted here to be within Dahndorf Forum, because exactly, this book is a letter to Ralph. He was at this university, and only later in our college. And he was one of the very few who was a practitioner and an intellectual. He was member of the European Commission, he was minister in German government. The reason I wrote a letter to him, because I tried to understand what the heck is going on in Europe. And I kind of had a deja vu, but in the reverse order. Because when communist collapse in Eastern Europe and Europe became whole and free, Dahndorf wrote a book which was called Reflections on the Revolutions in Europe. He wrote it to a Polish friend, unidentified, and he modeled it on a letter of Edmund Burke to a friend in France, which was Reflections on the Revolution in France. And this book, which was exactly written in a form of loose reflections without usual academic rigor, influenced a lot of us at the time. And the reason I decided to write to him was exactly because I thought we are now going in reverse. He thought about liberal ideas basically spreading around in the whole continent. He didn't believe what Frank Fukuyama argued, you know, the end of history, but he basically thought, okay, this started in Western Europe and America. Now is the stage where it's the whole Europe took it over. And he, of course, analyzed a lot of pitfalls, problems, complications. But, you know, when Berlin Wall fell down, and I remember Clinton went to Berlin and said, Berlin is free, everything is possible. And, you know, and I look around and you see on this picture and the same city and the story in reverse. And you look at Poland, my native country. How come that, you know, this country, which was the leader in embracing liberal ideas, now is going in reverse? People sometimes said, oh, the Poles, oh, they're all nationalists, they're all clerical. Oh, but they voted liberals for 30 years.
Post-communist school also embraced liberal ideas, by the way. And these things happen everywhere. In this country, I remember, I start actually a book reflecting on our meeting in European Studies Center the day after Brexit referendum. People cried. They couldn't understand. I bet you had the same experience here. Spontaneously, oh, everybody came. They couldn't understand what is going on. How come this seemingly pragmatic Brits embark on the road to unknown, really? You know, today even more, the meaning of that, yeah? And this happened everywhere. In Italy, we just had election, who won? Cinque Stelle and Lega Nord. Two very different, but both anti-liberal, anti-establishment parties. And they are now about to form the government. They will. I bet you they will. So, and you know the rest of the story. You know, it's not just that people of which we used not to know or take seriously carry the dead. Everything's got, I was invited to the European, you know, Research Center. The Director General asked me to talk about post-truth. He said, look, I employ 3,500 people. We do all this analysis, you know, we work hard. Nobody listened to us any longer. Not even in this building. And there is also a lot of anger, there is a lot of anxiety, mistrust, confusion. You know, in this country, Brexit became a kind of cultural war. But the local equivalent of this you see everywhere. I stopped going to television in Poland because people, you know, always want to tell me, am I on one side or on the other side? And here, it's exactly the same. In Italy, the same. And these are the questions that I deal with, yeah? What the heck is going on? And you cannot probably, as yet, try to be too scientific about this. You have to kind of reflect, and this is what I've done. It's a very personal story. And the story is very simple, you know. What is under attack is not just one thing. This is a package. All the pillars of liberal order, which we took for granted, are now being questioned. And you have the list there, I don't have to tell you, but see, sometimes people say, oh, this is only about migration. This is what PD thought, you know, Partito Democratico in Italy recently. You know, they minister, before election, the Minister of Interior Minniti, by the way, former communist, interesting thing, he introduced policies against migrants which were embraced by Lega Nord. They loved him. He didn't help them. Eh? They were wiped out. Because it's not about one thing. It starts with economics, goes to migrants, but then it goes to democracy, to culture, to basic issues. And of course, Europe is always there as a target, and I have to say, easy target. And as the Polish foreign minister once said something, you know, this was a beautiful citation in Die Welt. He gave interview, and he said, well, we have enough of those people who are not religious, who are vegetarians and ride bicycles, you know.
Fall off.
Enough, he said. It's also about dressing, eating, about all those things which urban, particularly multicultural cities take for granted. And the question is, why those voters in a number of countries, one after another, just abandon liberals? How come? And why they, you know, Cinque Stelle and Lega Nord is a beautiful example. No, they have nothing in common. One prospered in the north, the other in the south. One, of course, argued the things which benefit the rich. The other, you know, embrace policies which benefit the poor. You know, they're totally in the culture of the party. They're totally different. I know something of this because my son works with one of the politicians. So, but they have one thing in common. They don't want liberals at all. Out. And even those who are not really like liberals, like Berlusconi, like Cinque Stelle, De Maio and Berlusconi, over my dead body. Even those. And you know, and Financial Times and Economist here were praying that Berlusconi will stay in power. Eh? The stage is something about Europe today. Eh? And you know, some of those things, and then I have a number of chapters when I deal with various issues. Some of this has something to do with liberals, of course, and liberal thinking. And, you know, the famous story, you know, that liberals too much put emphasis on freedom, not justice, that they neglected communitarian values, you know, what David Gotthard, he argues in this country. But you know, here the story from Melesia, put it here, because how come? This is the irony of history. After war, two famous liberals were working in these buildings. Popper and Hayek. They didn't like each other very much. But Popper was great. Hayek was, Dahrendorf actually described in his book Hayek as, you know, as an eccentric leader of some kind of small sect of dogmatists. Well, but this was Hayek and not Popper who made history. Because he got the ear of Thatcher, Reagan, and Popper influenced George Soros, but and some intellectuals, that's it. So of course, their visions of liberalism very different. And all my friends who are specialists in liberalism, they will say, oh, crisis of liberalism, there is no one liberalism. And they will tell you, well, neoliberalism has nothing to do with liberalism. Yes, it is a package. It has become. Even Tony Blair, I was part of Third Way. We embrace many things I now regret. I have a feeling we allowed foxes into the chicken house. You know, you look at democracy, and the same. Many things has happened on liberal watch. How come that more and more decisions have been shifted to bodies never elected? Central banks, European Commission, courts, particular constitutional courts. You don't have constitutional court here, but many countries. And all the way in which decisions have been taken. Today, you know, after liberals started to lose elections one of another, they talk about weighted votes, which means, you know, only those who vote us will have double or three votes. You know? This tells you something about psyche. Eh? And of course, economics. Well, Walter is here, and Jan, I don't dare to say anything about economics, but how many crises we had in recent years, yeah? And, you know, I call it after somebody, it was, you know, it's very often media report, or the, you know, we start to believe that Chinese are responsible for globalization, yeah? Well, we have been, we as a liberal government in Europe and America, we've been the champions of globalization. We privatized, deregulated everything that was moving. And of course, you know, Euro crisis, you know the story. I don't have to go into details here. And of course, international relations, which became particularly tricky with terrorists, which, you know, we haven't been able not just to contain, we basically very often contributed to some of this, however terrible it sounds. And the refugee crisis. And you. At the end of the day, if you ask me what is the reason behind all this, I think it is the package. You know, liberalism used to be a set of ideas against those in power. They tried to plot how to constrain the king, that he doesn't do what she or he wants. But in the 90s and on, it has become ideology of power, of those in power, who define not just individual policies, but as all ideologies, they define the notion of normality. What is rational? What is crazy? What is good? What is bad? So the resistance to this is as fundamental as resistance to all ideologies. It is not just about migration. It is not just about austerity. Although, of course, the situation is different in different countries. Hungary actually experienced a lot of migrants. Poland hasn't. Poland grew 25% over the last decade. Greece contracted over 25% over the last decade. So, of course, local variations are different. And Grillo is more funny than Orban, provided that you know Italian or Hungarian, yeah? So these are all local things. But this, at the end of the day, it is about the package, the definitions of normality. And with, like with all ideologies, and therefore I have this deja vu from fall of communism, is that the king is next when people stop believing this. And in a way, Viktor Orban was the first one who said, I'm proud to be supporting non-liberal democracy. At the time, people thought it's crazy. All Hungarian dissidents were, you know, today also dissidents, in fact, you know, because there is no opposition in Hungary. But they were making fun of this. But now, they think history is on their side. They believe history is on their side. And actually, the only time the liberals were able to stay in power was because they embraced non-liberal policies and rhetoric. I've seen this in Holland. Rutte basically adopted anti-immigration rhetoric of Wilders. And Christian Democrats, to my enormous surprise, were even worse. Because Christian Democrats had the traditions of being actually very compassionate towards immigrants. By the way, in Poland, you know, the Pope, Poland, the most Catholic country, sees the Pope, most of people, as Antichrist, because he asks people to take migrants to their home. He's the enemy number one. Poor Francesco. This is the essence, in my view, you know. So you cannot just look at one policy. And it has something to do with EU too. And I don't want to go to a story, but you know, whatever explanation is, we are more or less coming to divisions of Europe which is on this map. Or if you prefer on this one, if you prefer geopolitics. No, this is 19th century. It's too simple. And the reasons, like in economics, like in democracy, are complex. There is no one way of doing those things. But at the end of the day, we have to acknowledge that the liberal record is rather disturbing. Because these were not populists in power when inequalities catapulted. Not just were tolerated, catapulted. And you know, even till today, they are being negated. In Poland, everybody says there is no inequality. Look at Gini coefficients, there is no inequality in Poland. Well, but Poland is a champion. Champion, there's no other country which has so many people on zero contracts. Who is going to pay pensions for them? They are totally, they have no rights. They're all, you know, without contract. In a country which grew 25%. And of course, economists, they all have the statistics, we tell you, oh yes, oh, Greece, yes, but... You know. And look at the map on Poland and compare the map, the eastern part, where peace was, is voting, you know, base, electoral base, and the left side, where this, where liberals still in power. And compare this with a map of new highways or new speed trains, and you see, it only deals with the part which is liberal. So forget those statistics, you know. I mean, these are good. And you've seen how all those things have been, you know, all statistics have been ignored in the Brexit debate. It is not that those statistics have no value, but as I told to my friends from the European Commission, this, you know, research center, I said, look, guys, there's one big problem. Would you believe scientific report on protection of environment prepared by Shell or Exxon? You guys have a conflict of interest. And I say to my colleagues in European studies too, how come that we have so many theories of European integration and not a single one on European disintegration? Well, can you study war? Can you study peace without studying war, or democracy without studying autocracy? Explain this to me. You cannot. I'm in favor of peace, but I cannot understand peace if I don't study war, right? And explain me why there are no theories of European disintegration. When 2 years ago there was a big congress in, you know, of Europeans in Paris, you know, there was only one panel on disintegration convened by New Zealander. And there were 700 people. Yeah, have you been there? I was there on this panel. But you see, how come? And look at those maps, because you see, these are maps prepared by my colleagues from Oxford Geographers. And they tell you a different story, because they are linked to statistical data. This is the story of Europe today. This is the thing which makes system break, and the institutions looking totally inadequate. These are the problems. This is Europe, eh? And not this one of member states and blue and with golden stars, eh? These are the maps of Europe. These are the maps of Europe. These are the maps of Europe, you see? They make everybody unhappy. Creditors and debtors, southerners and northerners. You see? And when this discrepancy was not so enormous, it was easier to make a deal. I always say this. When I mean, 12 or 14 years ago, Spain had the same unemployment rate as Germany. Now you know. Germany less than 5, Spain more than 20. Is it easier now to make any deal? So this is where we are. You don't have to be political scientist to understand. In fact, if you are political scientist, you cannot understand what is going on. because we have theories of order, but we don't have theories of chaos. And we ask ourselves a very difficult question, particularly in this country. So of course, and here I will end, everybody asks me, so what is the solution? Martin, first review of this book was written by Martin Wolf in Financial Times, and he said, oh, analysis is terrific, but what are the solutions? I said, "Kim, look, you are a wise man, but solutions, you know, are not like that, if you are serious." So it was Berlusconi who was going from the TV studio, most of them he owns, saying, flat tax. You introduce flat tax, everything will be fine. I will get you out of all the problems. It doesn't work this way. Particularly if you are liberal. And first thing you have to do is this. You know, I had a big, you know, argument with my publisher to put this poem into my book. Because, of course, to get copyrights for this is not easy, expensive. But this is the essence. The first step is understand that you have done things which are wrong. Because I was saying these were not populist, by way inequality catapulted, but populists in power when we invaded other countries and without UN mandate and then let them rot. And they were surprised that they are, you know, that they are refugees. And then the first things we try to do is to send military patrols to prevent NGOs to save those refugees, saying that we are basically targeting traffickers. And we pay again into pockets of Libyan warlords, I'm not even talking about Erdogan, and we think we solved the problem of migration. These were not populists who put those policies in place. These were not populists who orchestrated fiscal compact, the only reform EU has done for many years, imposed by Merkel and Sarkozy, basically, and go to the Southern Europe, to Greece, and see what is there. And Greece is in particular the situation because they made basically it's a protectorate. I look at Kevin, and he would not agree, but for me it's very simple. It's not a sovereign country any longer. It's run by creditor states who basically tell them particularly to keep all those migrants who arrive there because as it happens they arrive there in Italy. And you know in which condition. These were policies not orchestrated by populists, by liberals. So first we have to start with that, and also we have to say that those who screw it should leave politics. I'm sorry to say this, I'm very European, but how you want to revive Europe with people who is now in charge of the EU? Mr. Juncker? Who is a symbol of tax dodging. Mr. Tajani, who is a Berlusconi servant, you know, he nearly had Berlusconi won this election, he was candidate for prime minister, and using European Parliament post to campaign for Berlusconi in Italy. And Mr. Tusk, who prided himself that he has no vision. He said, if you have a vision, go to a doctor. So these are the people who are going to bring us to New Europe. Thank you very much. I'm not even mentioning that there is no single woman among those three, and they are all from right-wing parties. Because in fact, this is Europe which we have. Eh? And I know that here in the Brexit campaign it's very difficult to criticize you because you would be, you know, giving in to those who are in favor of Brexit for another fairy tale, yeah? I don't have to explain you here in Europe Institute. But it's very difficult to argue that pigs can fly. Sorry. And this is why the referendum was lost, because you cannot argue that pigs can fly. And there is serious problems there. Because how come that the European Commission has become basically an agent of these 30,000 lobbies in Brussels? It is only those officially registered, and not of the electorate. And deal with so-called civil society like with clients, only those who basically self-censor themselves, or academics are here in the first row. I work at the European University Institute, I can tell you stories. So, of course, it is not like this that you can fix those things, and I concentrate on Europe easily. Because Verhofstadt and some others may believe United States of Europe, but you don't get people on that. Bundesrepublik, Europa, great ideas. This is what we have more or less now, because formal institutions don't work. Where people go to fix anything in Europe? They go to Brussels? No, they go to Berlin. Otherwise, you cannot arrange anything. The problem, there's a small problem, is the Germans don't want to have any empire. They had enough of those. And they are not very good in doing this, by the way, too. Right? Doesn't mean that the Brits can teach them imperial politics. Well, this is the last thing they're waiting for. But so, not in the last book, but in the previous book, I talk, instead of current cacophony, we can have some kind of polyphony, but this sounds very abstract. But I tell you one thing, I will not go into details because I want to discuss this with you. But at the end of the day, it is not about money. It is not even about leadership. Because we are still, money is not about money, because Europe is still the richest part of the world. It is not about leadership, because it's not about charismatic leader who doesn't know where to go. It's about ideas. It's about paradigms. It's about mental maps. It's about us. And maybe not those in the first row, because we are too old to understand new world, but more about you in the back. Because, you know, as it happened, I was born before digital revolutions, which change finances, which change everything. So it is about that kind of things. And intellectuals are not doing very well. They debate details, which today are important. How to make border in Ireland, which is not a border. Of course, intellectually, it's like, makes me think about the Catholic Church and the concept of Trinity. How to insist there is one God in three. So probably they should engage in that kind of. But at the same, we have to think in a broader terms how the Union or Europe, because maybe the Union is passé, but integration is not passé, because we are living in an ever more interconnected environment, whether we like it or not. And the idea that you can take your toys and go back home to nation states and everything will be perfect is for the birds, unless you are Boris Johnson. Good for him, eh? I spent 2 days with him, so I realize more or less what we are talking about. But the point here is, but I always say one thing. If you cannot go up to the United States of Europe, because this would mean collective suicide of states, and they control integration. You cannot go down, because going down with Brexit, you already know. To untangle these 20,000 laws and regulations, only lawyers will get rich. Everybody else will lose. I only say, if you cannot go up or down, go sideways. So try to find a different way of integrating. And here there are interesting things. You know, people usually, economists, they talk about variable geography, geometry. But this is passé. This is very static. This assumes that states are major actors, the structure is, you know, rather simple, and you can legally determine who is in, who is out, you know. But if you look, if you talk to financial specialists, those who specialize in money flow, this is the world, Europe, we are talking about. This is totally different Europe. This is a slide prepared by my colleague from Oxford, who is financial geography. Or if you talk about security issues, it's again different stories. You know, in security, we have, of course, Mrs. Mogherini, also we have NATO, although I don't know whether we still have NATO, because the leader of NATO doesn't know whether Article 5 applies. So if you don't know whether it applies or not, you don't know what NATO is any longer. But that doesn't matter, because actually NATO or European forces, we had never used to crucial things. We used coalitions of the willing. We used contact groups. We've done many different things, sometimes very good, in a different way. Therefore, I call it floating islands, because il flottant is my favorite Belgian dish, no, dessert, you know. I don't know whether you know il flottant. If you look at refugees, it's more those asymmetric flows, right? If you look at NGOs, it's more kind of chaotic pluralism. If you look at social networks, it's more this kind of particular digital social networks. It's more this cyber-speciality. And with Waltraud, we've been in a group of researchers from different fields trying to understand those things. So as you can see, I came to the end. We are somewhere in space. I don't know whether this is the most comfortable place to be, but I'd rather have be there than in this atmosphere of agonizing conflict, everybody against everybody, with really no solutions to get out. And this is my reflection on Europe. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So you have heard this. Those who have to leave now, I just would like to mention there is a book sale outside for £10 a book from Oxford University Press, card payment only, not cash, please. While you're collecting your thoughts to ask some questions, let me just ask one, please. Jan, I mean, what I really like about this book, it doesn't start to, you know, weigh into the chauvinist populist or however you want to call them. They're also quite a diverse group, as we know. But rather ask this question, what has gone wrong with our liberalism if that has not convinced people and there's now this big backlash against it? And you said so nicely, you know, liberalism was actually, liberals are always the one who plot against those in power. And the crisis started when those liberals became themselves the powerful. Now, if one takes that further, then in a way there is quite a happy story there, because in a way you would say perhaps this that we call the illiberal populists today are just the new liberals, in the sense of they go against this ruling ideology, you know, we need checks and balances and independent judiciary and this, that, and open borders. And they maybe look a bit unwashed and not quite as we would like them to express themselves, but that will over time, you know, sort itself out, and then we have them here. So, and the whole thing would more look like a cyclical phenomenon rather than this fundamental decline of liberalism that you seem to make out. Why are you skeptical about the more happy reading of your
look,
story?
Had I knew what will be tomorrow, I would be a rich man. But as you know, in future studies, we never get good value for money. But there is industrial future studies. I don't know. I mean, I always say, I don't know what will happen. What I know is the following, that as much as we've done many things wrong, and I say always we, although I never was in government, the very simple thing is that new elites always have problem to adjust and to find solution. Now, what I don't believe is the right solution is going to the nation state at a time that economic and communicative transactions are moving beyond nation states, and states cannot implement their basic functions. Yeah, people accept that states basically gave up controls on many economic assets themselves or were deprived, but they think, okay, but defense will have to be done by nation states. But they forget that first of all, territorial defense in an age of nuclear weapons and cyber attacks is a rather peculiar idea. They forget that today, I mean, in Poland, there was, during Russian intervention in Donbass, and, you know, Poles are not great friends of Russia. There was a poll, what you will do if your country is being attacked. And Poles are very patriotic, you know, they don't like Russia. And majority wrote, we will immigrate the same day. Only a small part of the people wrote, oh, we will defend the enemy with weapons in hand. And actually, from military point of view, I used to work in here, it was around the corner, in the International Institute for Strategic Studies, so I understand a little bit about military issues, and one thing I understand is that young boys in uniform Kalashnikov is not the defense you can practice these days. It is more for your psychological state, but as you know, defense issues is not a question. It's not only about therapy, yeah, national therapy. And the Poles love national therapy. They think they will get two patriots and they are safe from Russia if they cross with them. No, these two patriots will be the first target in any conflict. I mean, what I want to say is that even in the field-like defense, when you assume and look how much private contractors basically take out of national defense budgets. Yeah? In America, we learn, because these things are usually not public, but in America, we know during operation in Iraq, more than 80% went to private contractors. And this tells you something about the notions of public versus private, you know, because national defense was supposed to be public good, not a private enterprise, that you do war like you do a public transport, which became private. You provide it only when it brings you money. If it doesn't bring money, let people walk, yeah? So what I want to say is that even the notions of defense is, in the new world as we are, rather peculiar. I don't want to say that I never ever said, and you will not hear from me, that states are not important. They are still very important. But the way they function is totally different than it used to be. And largely, and here is very theoretical story, you know, studying Tilly or even Ariel Weber and his disciples, that states became, after medieval period, the dominant actor, and not cities, and not papacy, not principalities, and so on. Because they were able to do one thing. They were able to provide overlap between economic, legal, cultural, and administrative borders within one territory under one government. Now, this is history. This doesn't exist anymore. So if this is true, and I believe it is, you have to think about the role of the states and other actors in totally different way. You cannot just go back to nation states. In my previous book, when I argue what you have to do is, first of all, if you want to have integration, you have to abolish monopoly on states on integration. You have to let cities come in, regions, enterprises, NGOs. And you know what? I had second man of the UN on Monday in Oxford, and you know what he told me? I work now with cities and some states which want to work with me, because I gave up already on my most beloved member states, particularly those who are in Security Council. If I want to implement, you know, for instance, environmental agenda or sustainable development agenda, I have to work with other people and other institutions. So therefore, I believe that the idea that you go back, because most of them believe you go back, is simply not workable. Mm. Now, I don't, since most of intellectuals, not all of them, I have to emphasize, are in the liberal camp, I expect from them to do better. And I, in your field, in economics, you see, I'm not an economist, I cannot really pretend, but I read Piketty. I see that he knows a lot about inequality, but when I read what he writes about Europe, I think I go to the library guy. You know, the same, you know, you see what I mean? We just don't know. And think about democracy. The only people who experiment with democracy are so-called left-wing populists. Cinque Stelle, Podemos, they use internet for democracy. We use internet for everything, but not for democracy. Come on, we have to wake up. Democracy, and the point is that unless we rethink how to run markets, how to do democracy, which means bring people back, we will never regain trust of the voters. And also, if we don't learn to do integration differently, and I don't expect from them to find it out. They, as you said, they will try to correct mistakes, and we've made a lot of mistakes. But I haven't seen yet ideas how to do it really better. And when things go wrong, the new elites, you know, from history.
I mean, it seems to me that you then have a slightly different analysis, that the liberals have simply, you know, outlived themselves, and we find out now that it depended so much on a nation state order. And without this, we cannot just go cyclically back and have to rethink. So the populists are not the new liberals, they just almost are the symptoms of a new order that we still don't see, and that's a post-state
Their role
order.
Is to correct past mistakes. I think this is their historical role. They will be swept away. They will not survive in most of the cases. But don't assume that the old come back. No, there will be. I see it already in Poland. You know, there are much harder forces than current government. They are softies comparing to those who march on National Day of Independence, you know. Hmm.
Let's hear from the in the back, and then here. And do I see another hand there? No? No. Please introduce yourself. Wait for the mic and introduce yourself briefly. Here, I can take one more if you show me your hand. Please.
Hi there, my name's Adib. I have two questions. My first one is, are you suggesting that Europe embraces violence or a sense of anarchism in which it literally does nothing and it allows the answer to emerge? That's my first question. My second question is, coming off the back of sort of this conversation around Podemos and city-states, et cetera, and this argument against liberals, this kind of reminds me of a Slavoj Žižek talk, which he basically comments on the film Reef of Vendetta, when he says, in the film, the fantastic thing about it is right at the end, you've got all these people, and they do this march on Parliament, and then the film ends. And it's almost like in Greece, it's a similar sort of thing with, I think it was Syriza once when they got in power. You had this huge protest, eventually they got into power, and then the problem was that, and then what? The fact is that there are no answers. How much would you say that in itself is the problem, the fact that there are no ideas and there maybe needs to be, perhaps, a doing nothing?
Okay. First, I don't think we are in the stage of any violence. And this is why people, you know, it's not a revolution when people are just building barricades. They are just winning elections. You don't have to build barricades. They're winning elections. These are liberals who do not like elections any longer. And I always say, yes, democracy is not only about elections, but you cannot do democracy without elections either. So that's the problem. If you believe in democracy, you have to win elections. And I've seen it first because, of course, Hungary, in a sense, was precursor. The very moment they lost, they started to travel to Brussels and not to villages to campaign. And I see it in Poland again. I see it in Italy again. I mean, Renzi just did everything wrong he could. And now he says, oh, I will rebuild Europe with Macron. No, go to Basilicata and try to convince those people why you lost first time after war there. And not only to Cinque Stelle, but Lega Nord. In Basilicata? So, but you see, Renzi is a beautiful example. He came to power and he stopped talking to anybody. He was just tweeting, change, change, change. When people got fed up of these tweets about change, he started to tweet revolution, you know. But at the moment, people realize in Italian it's called aria fritta, which is hot air, but not hot air, fried air.
So that type of example that you're giving, in terms of, for example...
Can you wait for the mic? We cannot have it on the podcast otherwise.
Right. Surely in terms of sort of how you're responding is that these elections are the violence. And I think the violence that you're perhaps indicating towards in terms of sort of typical revolutionary sort of burning cars and sort of Paris 68 almost.
Short, please. That's
you're almost indicating that the elections themselves are not violent and the actions of the individuals in power by going along with a very particular type of strain of liberalism and this false sense of care is not a violence.
Okay.
Look, first of all, I'm old enough to know what structural violence means. I knew actually personally Galtung.
We've been
traveling to Dubrovnik, so I know the story. But I don't think this is what... I come back to structural problems in a second, but I don't think those elections are being falsified. So far, not. But of course, and I think a lot of money has been spent and a lot of effort been done to prevent those sources coming to power. In Italy, let's not forget, Lega and Cinque Stelle won on electoral law, which was designed by Renzi Berlusconi exactly against them. Imagine now, with majority, they change electoral law. But they don't even have to change electoral law, because if there is no government tomorrow, and if elections are in October, Berlusconi and PD will be swept aside, even more. In Poland, everybody thought that peace won and they will discredit themselves immediately. Now our opinion polls are much higher than ever. So you see, this is what people, and I think people were very patient. They voted other parties time and again, and at a certain moment they said, oh, now enough is enough, we try something else. So you cannot say here that they are just manipulated. I'm sorry to say this, because this was the response of my friends liberal each time they lost elections. Michnik said something outrageous, also sexist, you know, in the interview with a cite in the book after he lost election. Michnik is kind of leader of liberal newspaper, for which I write myself, and he's a good friend, but he said something what I found outrageous when the journalist asked him, so how come that you lost, that the liberals lost? And he said, oh, you know, it's like this with the drunken woman who go to bed with a bastard. No, come on. Can you imagine the arrogance of this? Each time the message was Clinton in America, what she said, all those crazy people voted Trump.
Deplorable.
Sorry?
Deplorables.
Yeah, deplorable people voted Trump. Well, but they are citizens. And how do you democracy without election? I know, and you can do, you cannot. Democracy is about constitutions, rights of minority, divisions of power, I know. But you cannot do without elections. Now, structure. Greece is a beautiful case, and I finish here. Of course, it's not enough to have an idea. There is power behind, there is money behind. There is not, you know, and Greece was a beautiful case. They call his bluff. And we know that it was bluff. I asked Kostias 2 weeks before referendum, do you have plan B? He said, of course we have. Plan B. We know that when Varoufakis tried to have plan B, they threatened him with the Constitutional Court. No, so this is, of course, about the paradigm. This is only where it starts. If you have to put it in practice. And it's not like this that, you know, those on both sides of various equations, you know, of power or money will give up and say, oh. And in fact, in history, and this is what Waltraud said, in history, we never had progress because enlightened monarchs said, oh, I will improve things. No. Heads were cut, as you know. And we are not still there. Hopefully we will not.
Kevin. And then you are next.
Thanks. Kevin Featherstone from the European Institute. Thanks, Jan. I enjoyed the presentation very much, and you made some powerful points. Towards the end, I was left to wonder, why is the European Union even worth defending? Your final slide was to refer to functional integration. You showed maps of an interconnected world. It reminded one of earlier writings, pre-European Union writings, of people like David Mitrione talking about functional integration across the world. So I took part of your argument to be that actually the European Union has been outgrown. It's past its sell-by date in that kind of logic. If I may, a second question. The example that you've not addressed perhaps adequately is the success of Macron in this anti-liberal Europe argument you're making. Do you have no faith in that support, in that particular counter case? How would you interpret his success in France?
Can we
Thank
take
you.
One more question? The lady over there, the white.
Hi, thank you. So I work for a building construction company, and I noticed that pretty big, and I have to say that they're pretty short-sighted when it comes to what is the, let's call it common good. So how can we integrate privates into what is a long sight that a state must have, for example? And then another thing is democracy. Calling back citizen means also giving them the instruments to understand how things works and the critical sense, and that takes a lot of effort from the base. And then third, about Renzi,
I think... What was this question just now? Sorry. You may have to remind Jan. What was your question?
I got the question, so don't worry.
Oh, okay.
I know exactly where she's coming from.
And third, about Renzi, I think that his biggest mistake was actually doing something. The biggest enemy of Italy is doing. So that's where he got wrong.
Okay. Actually, your first question is very much aligned with the first questions of Kevin. See, now in this crisis, there are a lot of particular left-wing, but not only right-wing, but also left-wing thinkers like Wolfgang Streck in Germany, or like in this country, Corbyn. Mm-hmm. Who basically believe, okay, we gave up those controls of the state, we privatized everything, we have to go back to the state and restore what it was. I don't think this is possible. I think it is not possible. I think that a lot of work I've done in the past was on governance, and the first lessons you learn on governance is that the governance system has to reflect complexity on the environment you govern. So as those transactions, communications, and flows are becoming more and more transnational, you have to rebuild public authority which states lost on the transnational equivalent level.
So now, international law, not European?
It depends. I don't hear, and here it's very important, we shouldn't simplify this, because actually on democracy and identity, you have to be closer to the local environment rather than international. But on, you see, I always give this beautiful, you may know it, this Robert Dahl beautiful essay during the Danish referendum in 91. And Robert Dahl said at the time, he said, democracy is the stronger when it's participatory, and the participatory is closer to the people. So of course, giving more powers to Brussels, it will be less participatory, because the government in Copenhagen is obviously closer to you, and I would say Copenhagen in your village or district of the city is closer to you even more. But he said, but participation is not only criteria for democracy. Democracy also has to be efficient. And the government in Copenhagen may be closer to citizens, but it doesn't have the scale to address problems of efficiency, because the problem is that in the EU we base all legitimacy of EU on output and not on input, inputs of citizens, but output. We assume that if the EU delivers the goodies, people will give them, as we called it at the time, you know, permissive consensus. We just allow them to do the things because they assume they have the. But you know what is this output legitimacy when it is good? It's good when the weather is good. But when the weather is bad, you need people to stick to the project. The fear that they own it. So what I want to say is not necessarily that we move all on the high level and it has to be Europe in it. No. Functional, and here Mitrani is very good. Because Mitrani, read Mitrani, he foresaw the crisis we're in today, because he wrote already in the 50s that integration based on monopoly of states will come to the moment they will have to commit suicide to, because there will be functional spillover, and they will have to basically dissolve themselves and move the powers to the European center. And look at the history of European integration. There was always proliferations of laws and rules. There was progressively system of policing those rules, but very little transfer of governance, because German Bundestag doesn't want parliament in Europe to decide on their behalf. And very frankly, we've seen it, that we gave European Parliament more and more powers, and less people bothered to vote in European election. And those who voted for Farage, Le Pen, and the others. But this is not all and nothing, because you can even conceive Parliament with a second chamber with cities, organized citizens, you know, will have a say. But we have to start doing things, trying to do those things, because I haven't seen, we have how many years, all of you who study integration, at least for 20 years, tell me what was the reform. There was always talk about reform. And we were not even able to stop this parliament traveling between Strasbourg and Brussels. But now it's too late. Even if we would stop this circus, people will not start loving you. It's too late. We could stop. And so what I believe, that if you really believe in multi-level and so, you have to have different fields of integration organized in different space along different paradigms. Because, for instance, I always say, why would Hungary have the same interest in maritime traffic than Britain or Italy? And maritime traffic requires different kind of governance than food safety or pharmaceutics. Yeah. So in this sense, I'm like Mitrani. Yeah?
There was also one question of the lady, namely, would Renzi have not been better off by not doing very much and just sitting still?
Macron, I come back to Macron.
And Macron.
Your point now seems to be creating a world of confusion. Legitimacy comes from public understanding. You've outlined a map in which some integration is international, some is European. This democracy can only be participatory at the local level. How is this helping public understanding?
Yeah, but this is relies to the lady question. You know, I don't believe in this elitist, you know, that we are here in this room the only one who understand the word on the simple people. They have the voting, you know, and they support everything. Come on. This doesn't work this way. I was, you know, my first field was Roman law. So I studied a lot of medieval world. And everything was much more complicated than now, and people didn't feel lost in the universe, you know, like Gotthard described, you know. People build their identities depending on situation. They have understanding of the world. These were us, as academics, who were trying to simplify, you know, the reality of European integration in a way which didn't correspond to ever more complex realities. This way, us, you know, when I remember, even in visual terms, I remember Rem Koolhaas was asked by Prodi to prepare anniversary of the EU with the new exhibition in Berlin to have it more. Have you seen what he has produced? It's beautiful. People only know the European flag composed of all the flags, but there were buildings he proposed, his famous architect, you know. There were various, and my favorite was, you know, the vision of a lot of crowd on the Berlin Wall and gays kissing each other, even Honecker kissing Brezhnev and then Schmidt and so on. And bureaucrats got scared. And they didn't promote this because they liked these blue pictures with the stars, you know. And you know, when I published this book on Europe as Empire, when I met medieval empire, but people didn't read it, Barroso came to me and said, oh, I like the book, you know, we will be an empire like America and Russia. No, I said medieval empire.
Yeah.
You see, I mean, we have to change narrative. And therefore, I believe it takes years. Not only we don't know how to, and by the way, we would solve European integration project probably easier than problems of democracy or capitalism. Eh? And this is all linked. And this is why I was talking, this revolution is not just about one thing. Had it been about one thing, about austerity, or about migrants, we may find solution, but this is about the package. Oh, Macron, one sentence. And this is what I don't see in Macron ideas. You know, Macron makes me think a little bit about Renzi. Young, promising, when Renzi came to power, everybody thought, oh, this is the leader of left. Macron, people who know him personally told me that he's more educated and he listened to people more than Renzi. But you see, I read his book about revolution, you know, it's all Europe, but it's all Europe understood France. Maybe 2% about Europe proper, the rest is how France will be good in Europe. And you know, and Italians who thought that he's the savior of Europe, old newspaper where Macron was elected, look, he was there. 3 months or 4 months later, they were writing, Macron declared war on Europe. Why? Because he, you know, left Italy in the dock with migrants. He negotiated with the Libyan warlord a deal which affected Italy without Italians, behind their back. And then when the Italian firms wanted to take over one of the shipyards, you know, he nationalized it to prevent it. So much about Europeanness, eh? And of course, he crossed also with Poles and others because of the directive of the you know, services and so on. Come on, he has no friends except in Washington these days. Eh? You don't go very far.
One, yes. Two, three. So, and then.
But, sorry, but I give him a benefit of the doubt. Sorry.
That was that one sentence you wanted to say about
Bangkok. Yes, thank you very much for your sharing. I was wondering the liberal in retreat and
who,
then the coming
sir,
back of the...
Sir, who are you?
I'm Shi Sen-Chuan from National Taiwan University. I'm from Asia. I was wondering, maybe you can share some of your view about the liberal in retreat and then the coming back of the authoritarian or illiberal. It's not just only in Europe, also all over the world. You can see the Russian, you can see the China, you can see the president of the Philippines or the president of the Venezuela. No kind of the illiberal or authoritarian authors or the leaders has been coming back. So I'm thinking about any kind of the international factors you can mention about that. For example, the China uses a lot of the official development aid, international development projects to influence the European, those kind of things. And then this kind of linkages between the all over the world actually is illiberal has been coming back together. So from that perspective, all liberals in the all over the world, in different corners, how can we become together in solidarity, in whatever projects to do this kind of fighting back about the coming of this kind of coming back of the illiberal or the coming back of the authoritarian regime? Thank you.
Could you hand over the microphone at the back?
Thank you. I'm Ben Ryan. I'm a work for a think tank called Theos, and I'm also an alumnus of the European Institute here. My question is whether actually the transition you're looking at in terms of this European liberalism is as real as it seems. And that basically, I suppose my question is, was European liberalism ever that popular? It basically coincided with decades of household income increases, of you know, rise in living standards across certainly Western Europe and for Central and Eastern Europe in the 90s and early 2000s. And people forgive a lot for that, for their kind of politicians, if things are just getting better. But it's not clear to me quite how popular, beyond the kind of intellectual middle classes, this kind of vision of European liberalism that you're laying out ever actually was, or how deep-rooted it really is.
Thank you, Ben. Could you hand it over to the...
Hi. John Lutkin. I live in France. I work mainly in London and Munich at the moment, so I feel myself directly concerned. Things fall apart. The centre cannot hold. It's a line from Yeats that was widely quoted after... Brexit.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Things fall apart, the centre cannot hold, is the line from Yeats that was widely cited after Brexit. A line or two later, he says, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. I don't know if that rings any bells with anyone. I think you've shown this evening that probably none of us believe in the whole liberal package anymore. I don't, you don't. At least as it's instantiated at the moment. So where are we going to find any conviction?
Can I squeeze in one more question? There's a lady behind, and then we've had done down this whole aisle.
Christine Denniston, just a member of the public. I'm a little confused, and I was hoping you could clarify for me the precise origin of the problem as you see it. You said that liberalism began as the philosophy of the protection of the powerless against the powerful. Is the problem that those people who espoused that philosophy became the powerful and therefore disappeared intellectually up their own paradox? Or is it that people, the powerful, co-opted the policies that grew from that idea in order to use them to protect the powerful, and those that were trying to protect the powerless either didn't realize that was what was happening or didn't come up with a viable alternative?
Okay, these are all very difficult but very, very good questions. I thought about this. You see, first of all, what liberalism is or what it is not is a tricky question, partly because there were many streams of liberalism. And it was never, you know, like this, that liberalism is only about freedom and not justice, for instance. But there were various streams. There were communitarian libertarians, like today most pronounced representative of them is Michael Sandel, yeah? Or Walzer, or in previous time Selznick. And they always worried that that individual is a deadly stream of excessive liberalism and individualism. It will cause a lot of problems.
because it treat people in abstract way and not doesn't understand that people live in community with certain myths and affiliations. So it's always very difficult to say who of those are liberals, and therefore I refer to Hayek and Popper, who couldn't be more different, and they both saw themselves as protagonists of liberalism. Moreover, it also differs from country to country, because the local context matters very much. I also know, because I had recently debate with Frits Bolkestein in Amsterdam, and he would tell you, you know, there are no liberals in the South because there are no liberal parties. My party is liberal, although the public told him immediately, your party is ultra-conservative now and not liberal. But, you know, and he and Nick Clegg would also probably try to defend and say, oh, the only liberal party is my party. But I try to go, you know, you have to sometimes go beyond the levels. I believe that most of center-left and center-right party in Europe embrace certain notions of politics and economics, with variations. Of course, Tony Blair was not Margaret Thatcher. He actually cared about and introduced some reforms which softened neoliberal age, so to speak, right? But they merged to a large degree. They all believe in certain model of society and markets, and they question only on the margins and international relations. And I think in international relations, the idea of humanitarian intervention was the point most difficult for those who study international relations, particularly international law. You know how tricky it is, and how tricky it was in practice. Think about Srebrenica. Eh? I know all about this because my friend was at the time Minister of Defense in Holland, you know. But you see that they all merge on this. That there were, of course, variety between center-left, center-right, but they didn't question fundamentals.
Where does then this international trend come from?
This is more complicated outside Europe and the United States. Mm-hmm. More complicated. I don't know Latin America well, but I know Asia pretty well. I traveled many times there. And I understand that, for instance, in Japan, corporatism was much stronger than in Europe. And it was based on different ideas, particularly this corporatism is not very liberal. Yeah. I know that China never subscribed to certain premises of liberal economics. They, look, this is the irony of history, that Chinese are now paying American debts, yeah, because they trusted, you know, invested more in American economy than they own, and when American economy crashed, you know, they ended up with the bill. But this doesn't mean that they endorse in as a principle. In Taiwan, for instance, there was a strong element of liberal democracy, or in Hong Kong, yeah? But this was not embraced universally. So this discussion is more complicated outside the Western world, so to speak, yeah? And you can argue that it never really pick up, that some rhetoric pick up. Because in Central Eastern Europe, it is a beautiful example of total imitation. I mean, there was some thinking during Solidarność time about new model of government. I remember Solidarity Manifesto was called, you know, grassroots commonwealth. But they all abolished. They went just for the package. And the EU played a big role here because they had to swallow these 20,000 laws and regulations as quickly as possible with no discussion. So all of this applies very much to the Western world, and we've seen it very clearly with the Arab Spring, where the colonial and religious factors was important, and where we've seen that they didn't do what Eastern European has done, including Russians initially. Yeah? Don't forget, Gaidar also embraced neoliberals. Jeffrey Sachs, who now advised Bernie Sanders, you know, he advised Gaidar totally different things, and we know how it ended. But what I want to say is that, yes, China, Russia, you can say, never embraced this ticket. And they are economically doing well. But I wouldn't demonize their power either. You know, I talk from time to time to Chinese officials, and I have a feeling they don't know how they achieve what they've got. And they certainly don't have export product for others to take over. You know, of course, many countries would like to grow so much as China, but how? We had that export product. Look at Eastern Europe. And so this is mock-up, but I don't believe, you see, this transnationalism applies also to those powers. I've seen Russia with the Donbas and things. Yes, we adopted sanctions, and we are so proud we keep those sanctions, although none of the Italian, I mean, now Salvini will in the government, he walks in Putin's T-shirt, so forget that there would be them. But you see, in Greece, it's also more complicated. But you see, when I've seen Putin, he was not hit by EU sanctions. He was hit by the flow of capital out of Moscow. And people just, you know.
And can I ask the question of Ben and John in a different way? Have we always been a bit less convicted liberals, as you make it in your book, and perhaps are now becoming these, you know, rather floating, flexible, ideologically quite flexible?
Of course, but this is always like this. You know, I come from Poland, which is so-called the most religious country under the sun, but I call it country of people, practitioners, and not believers. See, so of course, you adopt certain ideas more pro forma very often, and particularly it suits your career. So if liberalism is, you know, they repeat mantra. But, and I remember when Poland, for instance, was condemned by the European Court of Human Rights for CIA prisons. And all the liberals said, yeah, this is scandalous. I said, how scandalous? You know, you allowed people, you knew that they would be tortured. They came with bags of money, you know, to pay them off, and it's registered. And these people were tortured, and you don't want, you know, the court, European court said you have to pay, you know, compensations. I say this because you now have other problems of people who were expelled from the country. So, and, you know, and you didn't know anything about this, and now you, and there was all, of course I'm against torture. One after another was saying, but, you know, this is America, we could, it was American, you know, we could, cannot cross with America, do you want, To are you Putin supporter, you know, criticizing this, you want to cross with America? And others were saying, oh, of course I'm against torture, but they must have been terrorists, how else they were, you know. And it was on like that, you know. So of course this is all the liberals, you know, they preach one thing and do another if it suits them. Yeah, but, and this is why they pay the price. Or we pay the price, because as I said, it concerns not just politicians, but it concerns intellectuals too. And we should start with ourselves.
On this happy note, I think we have to to conclude. I think the Dahndorf Forum, Debating Europe, this was a good example for tonight. I thank the European Institute for supporting this talk. Remember, there's the book on sale outside. Jan claims that he has actually a happy message at the end, so you can find out from the book.
And you cannot trace my accent when I write.
Thank you very much.